Where I found Buddhist drummers who, I think, were drumming in favor of the treaty, but wouldn't stop drumming long enough to say. A homosexual group demanded that leftover ex-missile money go to AIDS research. Hare Krishnas were lobbying for the right to bother people in Russian airports, too. Eritreans wanted whoever it is who's in Eritrea to leave now. Some 60 peace activists seemed miffed because this arms deal came from guys in suits instead of people marching in Central Park. And one three-man organization with signs in Russian advocated the return of Major League Baseball to the District of Columbia. On the sidewalk in front of the White House, a large, angry crowd of people from places like Poland, Vietnam, the Ukraine, Afghanistan, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia were pointing out that the Soviets know how to cause trouble the regular way, no H-bombs required. An even angrier crowd of Jewish activists was getting itself arrested at the Soviet embassy. The Tsar spent 5 centuries trying to chase the Jews out of Russia. Now the Soviets won't let them leave. This is something the Russians should just make up their minds about. It was a bit of a shock to see the Soviet flag flying all over Washington, even though a lot of people in my family think that's what's been going on since the first FDR administration. Reagan's right-wing ex-pals were also not enthusiastic about that red dish rag. They want to know, is the Gipper channeling? That is, they assume Ron is a conservative Republican, at least in this incarnation, but perhaps he's gone into a trance-like state, and creatures from the spirit world are speaking through him. Eugene McCarthy, maybe. Such die-hard Bolshe haters put the kibosh on a proposed Gorby address to both houses of Congress. Congress already has plenty of dumpy bald guys who hardly speak English addressing it, said the right-wingers, with some justice. But Nietzscheans were a minority. Gorby fever raged in the Capitol, especially among establishment liberal types such as the ones who fill your TV screen every night at 7. These people were tripping all over each other about how reasonable, convincing, and just plain friendly Splotch Top is. They were even praising the Dread Ron for having Spot over to visit. This was a bit of a mystery since communists and Republicans both hate liberals. Reagan believes liberals should be deported to Russia, and Gorbachev believes they should be sent to Siberia. The two sides are in perfect agreement on this point. But you know how liberals live in the past. Maybe they think good U.S.-Soviet relations will put a stop to Hitler and Mussolini. Or maybe the liberals feel that if we're headed into a period of economic fuck-ups, we'd better get tight with the folks who wrote the book on fucking up economies. Vid das Kapital. Whatever. There's probably no truth in the rumors that Gorby will head the 88 Democratic presidential ticket. Constitutional difficulties about his not being born in the U.S. are one drawback, but the real problem is that Gorbachev's soft on trade sanctions and favors government deregulation of industry. Moment to remember, the historic signing came at 2 p.m. Tuesday, December 8th. It's a straightforward deal. Reagan needs something to keep his second term from being reviewed like a Madonna movie, and Gorbachev wants to save bucks on military expenditures. The Soviets are sick of surviving on bread and lard. They'd like to have a more westernized lifestyle with croissants and lard instead. It seems like an all right treaty to me. The Soviets have to give up 693 missiles, and we have to give up only 154. All the atomic warheads will be destroyed. That will create nuclear waste, which is good because this way, even if disarmament proceeds to its logical conclusion and atomic weapons are completely eliminated, anti-nuke protesters will still have something to demonstrate against and won't be unemployed. On the other hand, it's not a great treaty. Ron got the Redskies to sit down and talk butterball by being tough and filling Europe with cruise missiles and so forth. Maybe he should have been really tough and nuked Leningrad. The Soviets might have signed away the whole ranch if he'd done that. Also, the commies are the only people on Earth who think Star Wars will work. If they're that gullible, maybe we should have held the summit at Atlantic City and let them lose all their missiles playing Keno. Oh well, it's not as though either side really needs many warheads. A couple dozen apiece would do the trick. The Russians could have some aimed at Japan, so if we act up, they can destroy our economy. We could have some aimed at the Village Voice, so if the Russians misbehave, we can kill a lot of communists. After the treaty signing, many very important things happened, all of which I scrupulously followed in every painstaking detail on the giant screen TV at the Kit Kat Club. Make that a triple, please. This is another technical term journalists use, covering a story from Mahogany Ridge. Tuesday night, the Gorbachevs had dinner at the White House, and Mikhail kissed Van Cliburn a lot. Wednesday, Gorby met with congressional leaders and discussed whether the Soviet Union is an evil empire, or just like the United States, or both. Later that day, the Gorb met with a delegation of American intellectuals, led by John Denver. Raisa went to tea with Nancy. If body language is anything to go by, they got along like two cats in a sack. Raisa had to sit through the whole just-say-no routine, but managed to resist the temptation to shove the First Lady's face into a plate of cucumber sandwiches. On Thursday, Gorbo breakfasted with George Bush, but George just spent the whole meal buried in the Wall Street Journal, grumbling about bond prices. Barbara says that's the way he always is in the morning. And, of course, Ronnie and Splotch had a whole bunch more meetings, which seems to make everyone feel warm all over. I can't think why. The last time an old, sick, addled American president, Roosevelt, sat down with a Soviet leader who'd had great press, Uncle Joe Stalin, half of Europe was given away. Mexican Border Idol, October 1986. I just came back from a month on the Mexican border, where I personally captured 3 illegal aliens. This saved the United States a lot of money in welfare, social services, and unemployment benefits. Therefore, each of you owes me 50 cents. Unless, of course, you happen to be illegal aliens, in which case you owe me a kick in the ass. Thoughtful type readers, the kind who worry about the morality of the whole issue, may be confused about whether to send me money or wring my neck. I'm confused myself. A month on the border would confuse anybody. It was in Laredo that I captured my aliens. I didn't mean to capture anybody. I just got overexcited, temporarily forgot I was a journalist, and started acting like a law-abiding citizen. I was riding around town with a very affable young Border Patrol agent named Howard Adams. His job for the evening was to keep illegals from hopping the midnight freight to San Antonio. A radio call came in saying 3 aliens had been spotted slipping into an equipment pen next to the rail yard. The pen was a link-fenced half-acre filled with couplers, wheel trucks, and other giant rusty train junk. The moment we pulled through the gate, 2 young men hopped out of the scrap iron. Adams ran them down while I trotted after him, trying to take notes, get my flashlight to work, and not bark my shins on things. The illegals got as far as the fence, examined its height, shrugged, and surrendered. Adams locked these 2 in the car and went looking for the 3rd. I followed him as he ducked behind a derelict semi-trailer. He shined his flashlight underneath and said something in Spanish. There was a wiggling in the gloom. A rather plump adolescent had managed to squeeze himself into the trailer suspension, into a 6-inch gap between the axle and bed. He squeezed himself out, shrugged, and Adams marched him to the car. I peered underneath, jiggling my defective Ever-Ready, trying to see how somebody could fit in that minuscule space. Somebody could, I guess, and with room to spare, because when the light finally came on, there was another somebody staring at me. He had pushed himself even further back above the axle. "Howard," I shouted. "I found one more. Is there something that I'm, like, supposed to say to him?" "Say vamos," yelled Howard. "Vamos," I said. The fellow crawled out and stood next to me, shrugging a great deal. I looked back under the trailer to see how in the hell 2 people could possibly fit in that space, and shit, there was a 3rd guy, as squashed as filet of sole. I was beginning to feel like the circus cop arresting all the clowns in the miniature taxi cab. "Come on, vamos yourself," I said, and when he did, there was yet another goddamned kid packed in behind him. I had them all shrugging in my flashlight beam by the time Adams got back to the trailer. "Mi compadre es periodista." "My friend is a journalist," said Adams. The illegals nodded their approval, that they'd been busted by somebody with no power to do so, and no business doing it, and who, on second thought, wished he hadn't, seemed to bother nobody but me. One of the Mexicans said something, and Adams translated. "This is the 11th time he's been caught in 2 weeks." Illegal alien traffic is so heavy at Laredo that there's no time to take people back to the border one by one. A school bus with chicken wire over the windows is parked by the freight yard until it's full. It made 3 trips to the border that night, by no means a record. There was a lot of singing and laughing on the bus. The prisoners leaned against the chicken wire and traded jokes in Spanish with the Border Patrol agents. I talked to one of the women agents. "They're going up to get construction jobs in San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston," she said. "Mostly they're young men. They'll send for their families later. We see a few women and children through here, and we worry about them because the trains are so dangerous. There was one family with 2 beautiful little girls. We caught them 3 times. We haven't seen them for a while," she added with a slightly wistful tone. "I guess they finally got through." Adams took me to the freight yard where the train was being made up. It was terrifying in there. Switch engines were moving the stock around in the dark, and the sidings were so close together, there was only a shoulder's width between the rumbling boxcars. Shapes and shadows appeared in our flashlight beams as illegals darted through the crashing machinery. I saw one roll himself across the rail bed between moving wheels, trying to get out of our way. At the depot, a railroad detective showed me photographs. In one picture, a man, about 20, had been cut into 5 distinct pieces, 2 legs, a head, a torso, 1 arm. His eyes were open. He died so quickly, there wasn't much blood. "It happens 2 or 3 times a week," said the detective, "sometimes in the yard and sometimes out on the line. The wets are all afraid of snakes. They sleep on the ties because they think snakes can't get between the rails." When the train was ready to pull out, we went to the last switch onto the main track. As the locomotive moved through, dozens of Mexicans dashed out of the shrubbery and tried to grab hold of the gondolas and flat cars. Most of them fell back. The train was moving too fast. The illegals already on board whistled and waved. When the train was gone, Adams and the other agents rounded up the stragglers. One illegal said, "Will you drive around a little and look for my friend? He'll need a ride to the border." "Oh, for Christ's sakes," said Adams, and began scouring the neighborhood. The boundary between Mexico and the United States is 2,000 miles long with few natural barriers. It's just an imaginary map doodle through a bunch of scrub. There isn't even a linguistic gulf since the majority of people on both sides speak Spanish. But this ill-patrolled and undefended frontier is the one place on Earth where a fully developed nation collides head-on with the filth and chaos of the Third World. The burghers of Northern Europe have Italy's, Greece's, and Yugoslavia's between them and true want. The Japanese are a sea away from the needy Filipinos and Chinese. Even Russia has its own dirtball provinces of Kazakhstan and Uzbek to give it some distance from the hordes of Asia. But in North America, the poor and benighted stand with noses pressed against the candy store window, from the yacht basins of San Diego to the Yahoo party beaches of South Padre Island. A walkabout on the border raises all the big, ugly, stupid questions of the 20th century. What makes a Mexico a Mexico? What makes a United States a United States? And what the hell are we supposed to do about it? The Mexicans have another question. Why stay where money isn't when you can go where money is? A question they answer with their feet. And the U.S. Border Patrol doesn't have much of an answer to that. Manolo Ortiz, PR chief of the Immigration and Naturalization Service's Southern Regional Office, told me that in 1968, the Border Patrol nabbed 128,000 people trying to sneak into the U.S. In 1984, it was 1 million, and last year's total was almost twice that. 97% of these folks are Mexican, and though 2 million get caught, between 2 and 4 million don't. That means at least a couple Cleveland's worth of Mexican citizens gate-crashed our country last year. "We only have 3,200 agents in the entire Border Patrol," Ortiz said. "All it amounts to, really, is controlled illegal entry." An agent in Ortiz's office put it this way: "We could stand on the border with linked arms, and they'd still get across." Ortiz took me to meet the INS Southern Regional Commissioner, Stephen H. Martin. Martin is a prominent businessman from Louisiana, active in Republican politics, but not too full of gas for a federal appointee. "Our mandate," said Martin, letting a little of that gas out, "is to protect the border and to protect all the people along the border, regardless of nationality." Ortiz, who had a better sense of humor, said, There's a fence on the international boundary in El Paso. It's called the Tortilla Curtain. Aliens were cutting themselves going through the holes in it, so the government built a flimsier fence. What causes all this illegal immigration? I asked. Here was a real stupid question, but it's a stupid world. Economics, said Martin, looking as if he'd been asked a real stupid question. Okay, then, why is Mexico so poor? For the next month, I asked everybody on both sides of the border this question. The only answer I got that made any sense was from an El Paso bartender. He said, You know, this old Texas boy and this Mexican were having an argument, and the Texan says to the Mexican, How come you all are always mad at us and blaming America for everything and so on? And the Mexican says, You stole half our country, and not only that, senor, you stole the half with all the paved roads. There are a lot of other stupid questions that I asked, too. In McAllen, Texas, I asked Sylvester Reyes, chief of the Border Patrol division that covers the boot toe of Texas, if we should use the military to seal the border. The border is dangerous enough without bringing a wartime mentality to it, he said, and made a face. That's an obvious conflict in philosophy to use our military against a peaceful ally. In San Antonio, I asked Deputy Southern Regional District Director John A. Abriel what would happen if we did seal the border. Some congressmen have said if the border was sealed off, we'd get a revolution in Mexico, he said. Abriel looked tired and harried. He looked like a man facing a question so big and so stupid that it might need a big, stupid answer. But maybe, he said, sealing the border would give Mexico impetus to reform. Is the United States, I said, using its border as some kind of political safety valve for Mexico or something? I wouldn't throw that theory down the drain, said Abriel. I have a similar gut feeling. And he gave me another load of horrible wetback statistics. Look, said Abriel, illegal immigration is not malum en sa, not evil in itself. We sympathize with the illegals. We empathize. But the bottom line is the taxpayers expect protection, expect enforcement of the Immigration Act. I think it was President Taft who once met with an old Indian chief and asked the chief if he had any words of wisdom for the President of the United States. The chief said, Watch your immigration laws. In McAllen, I went out on night tour with two supervisory patrol agents, Travis Johnson and Benny Greenfield. Both were Texans in their 40s. Greenfield was a tall, laconic, cowboyish man who dipped snuff, as most agents do, lest a cigarette give them away on stakeout. Johnson was shorter and very kindly mannered, with a chuckle that might be called giggling in a man with less dignity and no gun. We drove to a low dike near the Rio Grande, overlooking half a mile of fallow bottomland. There are electronic sensors planted along the U.S. bank of the river, old Vietnam War equipment, the same sensors that were used to stop traffic across the DMZ and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And you remember how well that worked. The sensors are monitored in the Sector HQ, where an operator had radioed Johnson and Greenfield. There had been two hits below the dike. Greenfield had a pair of binoculars, and Johnson was trying out an experimental infrared scope that made him look like he was wearing a 19-inch television around his neck. Most of the illegals are good fellows, said Johnson. You'll see, we kid around with them. Although they didn't much, that I saw. The agents scanned the darkness until Greenfield said, Yep. Then Johnson handed me the infrared scope. It showed heat as light, so that the warm soil and grass glowed faintly. Coming through this luminescent hay were two brilliant, featureless silhouettes, looking like aliens indeed, like close encounters of the third kind aliens. It made me wonder, for a moment, how many nine-eyed refugeoids from collapsing white dwarf stellar systems are out there in the Milky Way. They'll head for the brush, said Greenfield. To our left, the front slope of the dike was covered with trees and undergrowth. Johnson went down to the foot of the levee, and Greenfield and I walked along the top and lay down in the grass at the edge of the shrubbery. A few minutes later, we could hear the illegals crashing through the sticks and leaves. Immigration may be a moral quandary, but, at the moment, it was lots of fun, too. I almost forgot the thumb-sized mosquitoes and the fact that I'd plopped down in what seemed to be a patch of fishhook plants. The noise came directly at us. It sounded as though the illegals would step out of the bushes onto Greenfield's head, and the first one almost did. Greenfield let him walk between us so that we were, the three of us, as close together as people in a cash machine line. As the second illegal came out of the woods, Greenfield jumped up. The second man did a back dive into the greenery, but his friend seemed too startled to move. Greenfield took him by the arm, and the fellow sighed and shrugged. When the first illegal had been locked in the car, we went through the strip of brush, just like you do to flush grouse. Greenfield pushed up the middle. I walked along the top of the dike, and Johnson took the edge of the field. It was a moonless night, and cattle were grazing everywhere. I walked into a cow and scared the socks off myself. Meanwhile, the second illegal disappeared, a gotaway, as they're called. We went to another crossing point, which Johnson said was a local favorite. There was a long, sandy road running down to the river between sugarcane fields. The infrared scope picked out two tiny bright dots, and we hid in the cane until an old man and a boy walked by. Greenfield and Johnson grabbed each by an elbow. Neither protested. They shrugged as they were patted down for weapons and put in the backseat cage with their countrymen. These three desperados had been caught red-handed. Their crime? Looking for work. If they'd pulled the caper off, they would have scored less than minimum wages in conditions not fit for farm animals. But they'd been nabbed. Now they'd have to face the music. Their punishment? Greenfield and Johnson would take them to the nearest international bridge and let them go home. "What do you do if they run away?" I asked Greenfield.
"I chase them."
"What if you can't catch them?"
"I let them go."
"You don't shoot them?" Greenfield looked shocked.
"What for? They're trying to make a living. They're not criminals."
He thought that over.
"They're just breaking the law."
The next day, I drove an hour and a half north to Falfurrias with Assistant Chief Patrol Agent Juan A. Garcia to look at a highway checkpoint. We pulled over a couple miles short at a rest stop.
"If somebody's carrying illegals," said Garcia, "they'll stop here and make them walk around the checkpoint to be picked up on the other side. It's a long walk."
We went over to the fence behind the rest stop to cut sign, as the Border Patrol calls tracking. The land was dry, baked scrub, hot and flat as a griddle for 50 miles in every direction.
"That business about Mexicans being close to the land and never getting lost and being able to withstand thirst and heat forever is nonsense," said Garcia, whose own parents had come over when nobody minded.
There were plenty of footprints at the fence, mostly cheap men's sneakers, but mixed with these were fresh prints from a woman's high-heeled shoes and from a small child's sandals. We followed the tracks 100 yards into the scrub. Those high heels must have pinched like a thumb in a car door. And how far did the kid get before it started to bawl?
"We'll check for them at the drag," said Garcia.
The drag looked like a wide dirt road crossing the highway between the rest stop and checkpoint, but it was raked daily so that any tracks across it would show. We drove for 2 miles along the drag without any sign of the little sandals or the high-heeled shoes.
"They've gone wide into the brush," said Garcia. "Sometimes we spot them because of the vultures."
At the checkpoint, the patrol agents had just caught a young man, an illegal, with 4 pounds of marijuana in his pickup. They opened the package for me, and I sniffed it. It was really 40-toke Am I High Yet Tampico ditchweed. I'll bet I wasn't the only person in the room who felt like a dick nodding over the gravity of this crime. The dope had been hidden in a hole cut through the floorboard behind the pickup seat. A section of sheet metal had been carefully sawed out and put back in place with auto body filler. Then it had been sanded, spray-painted, and covered with carpet. The Border Patrol agents were mystified about why anyone would go to so much trouble over 4 pounds of stems and seeds.
"Maybe it's a test run," said one of them.
"Or maybe it just shows how bad things are in Mexico,"
Garcia said to me while we were driving back.
"The Mexican minimum wage is $3.21 a day. Unemployment is 50%.
When we were about 30 miles from McAllen, Garcia spotted 4 illegals standing under a tree on the other side of the highway. They weren't hard to pick out. They were each carrying a little plastic grocery bag, usually the only luggage an illegal has. They wore shoddy jeans and dusty cotton plaid shirts. And they were thin, the way only very rich Americans and very poor non-Americans are. We were in an unmarked car, and when Garcia cut through the median strip to get to their side of the road, the poor ignoramuses stuck out their thumbs. Garcia patted them down and put them in the back seat. Manny got a snub-nosed revolver out of his briefcase and slipped it in his pants pocket. The illegals were all from the same little town near Reynosa. The oldest, who looked well past middle age, was 43. Two others were in their mid-20s. The youngest was 18. They'd come across the river somewhere, they weren't sure where, between McAllen and Brownsville, at 10 o'clock the previous morning. They had been walking ever since. It was 3 p.m. when we picked them up. They said they'd come out on the highway because they were hungry.
"Why don't you interview these guys?" Garcia said. "See what their lives are like."
I asked them how much money they had, Garcia translating. One said 1,000 pesos. Another said 500. The eldest had 400. That was a little over $2.50 among them. The youngest had nothing.
"Where did you expect to find work?" I asked.
"Wherever," said the eldest. He told me he had 8 children. He'd been to the United States 3 times before. The 2 guys in their 20s had each been twice. This was the first time for the youngest. When they'd been here in the past, they had worked on ranches, mostly picking fruit and vegetables.
"How long did you hope to stay?"
"As long as there was work," said the eldest. He had been here for 2 months the last time. Usually he got $2.75 to $3 an hour with room but not board. Garcia told them I was periodista, who worked for a magazine called Rolling Stone, Piedra Rolar. They all thought that was a very funny name for a magazine. They were still chuckling about it as Garcia escorted them to the pedestrian walkway across the border. Not everything that comes over the Rio Grande is quite this benign, of course. Since Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas cleaned up South Florida, Mexico has become the main drug route into the U.S. There's also a lively trade along the border in OTMs, other than Mexicans. These are aliens who get smuggled for a price out of South and Central America, China, Korea, India, even Poland. OTMs are routinely robbed by border rats, gangs who commit their crimes in the U.S., then slip back to Mexico. The Mexican illegals are robbed too, though there's little enough to take from them. And the Border Patrol has the highest casualty rate in the line of duty of any U.S. government uniformed service. I went on a drug stakeout with one of the agents from the McAllen sector.
"The smugglers are armed and they will shoot,"
said the agent, who was carrying a Heckler and Koch MP5 submachine gun. After hiding his patrol car, he and I stood alongside a road about a mile from the Rio Grande. Between the road and the river was a huge mesquite thicket.
"The joke along here," said the agent, "is that you can stop your patrol car anywhere on this road, blink your headlights 3 times, and the smugglers will run out and jump in your back seat by mistake."
He'd no more said that than a car came down the road at about 3 miles an hour. We hit the dirt. The car was a convertible with 2 flashy Latin girls in it, radio turned up loud. It rolled to a stop not 20 feet from us.
"This is it,"
whispered the agent, and he belly crawled forward, moving fast and soundlessly, until there was just one ragged shrub between him and the car. He could almost reach the door handle. I followed, more in the fashion of a trout across the bottom of a rowboat. I could see the agent slipping a clip into the MP5. I tried to muzzle my frenzied breathing by shoving my face into the ground, but that only got dirt up my nose. So I had to muffle my frenzied sneezes by shoving my face further into the ground, which got dirt between my chattering teeth. This went on for 30 minutes. So did the legion of bug bites. Finally, the driver turned off her radio. Giggling voices filled the night air.
"Antonio es muy simpático. Sí, sí, cómo no. Y Roberto es muy generoso."
We had been pinned down for a half hour by an all-girl heart-to-heart. The driver gunned her engine, and the 2 young ladies drove away to their disco date. But what does this tomfoolery look like from the other side? Not so snappy and dramatic, I'm afraid. I rented a car and drove along the south side of the border, from Matamoros on the Gulf of Mexico to Tijuana on the Pacific. It was what TV news cameramen call cut to obligatory squalor. The overfed white reporter goes around stuffing his microphone, or in my case, pencil, in people's faces.
"Just how poor are you?
Mind if I look around in your hovel?" Say, you wouldn't happen to have any kids that are a little more crippled or anything, would you? Anyway, it's a mess over there. To tell the truth, it isn't a worse mess than the Brownsville section of Brooklyn or downtown Detroit, but it's a different mess. Even in the best parts of Nuevo Laredo or Juarez, the pavement is coming to bits. There's garbage all over the place. The buses and trucks belch smut. Buildings are being made from such bum materials that it's hard to tell if the construction is going up or coming down. In fact, neither. Since the oil bust and foreign debt crisis a couple of years ago, most Mexican building sites are just sitting there. The individual poverty was grimo, but it was the corporate, the commonweal poverty that jerked the senses. Mexico isn't just squalid homes. It's squalid industry, squalid infrastructure. No adequate capital investment has ever been made in Mexico, not even by capitalists in the machinery of their capitalism. The whole country looks like it's run by slum landlords, especially the bathrooms. There aren't many sewage treatment plants in Mexico, or, for that matter, many sewers. Even septic tanks are a luxury. Mexico is a nation of cesspools, of holes in the ground. You can't put toilet paper in a cesspool. That clogs it. So all the used toilet paper goes in waste baskets or, more often, cardboard boxes on the bathroom floor. Except people forget, and half the toilets in the country are overflowing. I think public restrooms are crucial to understanding a culture. Look at the street-side pissoirs of France, the ancient water closets of Britain, the ceramic relief palaces of the United States. But don't go to the John in Mexico unless you plan to learn more than you want to know. Besides bathrooms, I figured I'd also better go see some politicians. If you're looking for fleas, you have to lie down with dogs. When I got to Juarez, across from El Paso, I went to the local headquarters of PAN, the National Action Party. The acronym means bread in Spanish. PAN would be the opposition party if there were such a thing in Mexico. But the ruling party, the PRI, has won, by this means or that, every presidential and gubernatorial election since 1929. PRI stands for Institutional Revolutionary Party, a name that manages to include most of mankind's bad ideas about governance. PAN occasionally wins a municipal election. PAN HQ was a large building in one of the better commercial districts, but all the windows were broken, and the walls were defaced with spray paint. I arrived in the middle of a press conference, as boring a thing to sit through if you don't know the language as it is if you do. When it was over, instead of running for the bar like American reporters, some of the journalists stayed and argued vehemently with the PAN spokesman. They were employees of the government-controlled papers and TV stations. Imagine Peter Jennings giving you grief on the air and then sticking around to tell you President Reagan thinks you're a shit too. When all the reporters had finally left, I asked Juan Torres, the pissed-off-looking president of the PAN Juarez Committee, my favorite question. Why is Mexico so poor?
Corruption, said Torres. We are in a sea of corruption. There has been nearly 60 years of the same party. Because of that political party, we have not become an economic power.
What should the U.S. do about illegal Mexican immigration? I asked. But Torres had had enough for one day.
The U.S. can do what it likes, he said,
and handed me off to PAN committee member Pepe Marquez. Marquez spoke very quickly, as though the Mexican social disaster might overtake us at any minute, and he'd have to hightail it across the Rio with the rest of the wetbacks. He, too, blamed everything on the PRI, throwing in many statistics about how the Mexican government controls 75% of business and industry, and 80% of agricultural land and so on, the kind of facts and figures responsible reporters dutifully copy down and all readers blithely skip. In the news trade, this stuff is known as MIGO, short for My Eyes Glaze Over. Marquez noticed that I was beginning to snooze. He paused, trying to figure a way to put his case succinctly.
If the government was given the desert to manage, he said, there would be a shortage of sand.
Is there something the United States should be, you know, doing? I asked.
The Mexican government, said Marquez, is kept alive by the United States agreeing to bank loans.
Interesting that our administration, so sis-boom-bah about anti-communism, is footing the bill for their administration, which sounds pretty communistic. Well, I said, how'd your windows get broken?
A group of leftists did it. The CDP, the Committee for Popular Defense.
Did they attack the PRI offices, too?
They never attacked the PRI.
Why'd they hit you and not the ruling party? Marquez gave me one of those world-explaining, whole-body Latin shrugs, an educated version of the shrugs I got from the illegals on the border.
The CDP, they are supposedly against the government.
I drove south out of Juarez, across the beautiful edges of the Sierra de la Magdalena Mountains, through the prairie scrub of northern Chihuahua State, and into vast rolling hills, green and well-watered, and empty. A Cleveland a year, full of would-be immigrants, could be built out here for decades. In Chihuahua City, the Institutional Revolutionary Party was setting up a press conference, too. President De La Madrid would address the media the next day in an enormous hotel ballroom full of comfortable chairs, buffet tables, red velvet draperies, and putting green-sized Mexican flags. I asked the party officials for a PRI spokesman, and they got me an appointment with Arturo Ugalde, the Chihuahua State Director of Economic Development. I had an hour to kill, so I went sightseeing. There was a beautiful 18th-century colonial Baroque palace on the main plaza. Father Hidalgo, the leader of Mexico's revolt against Spanish rule, had been imprisoned here until his execution in 1811. The walls of the palace courtyard were covered with murals painted by Piña Morey in the early 60s. They depicted, in heroic style and with villainous content, the entire history of Mexico. The literally heart-wrenching Aztecs were shown sacrificing people and skinning them alive. Then came the dirt-sack conquistadors, with dim Montezuma mistaking Cortez, of all people, for a god. Then Catholic missionaries converting the Indians to death. Father Hidalgo figured large, murdering Spanish civilians and getting the stuffing kicked out of his revolution in its only pitched battle. Mexico didn't become independent for another decade, not until the local Spanish aristocrats declared it independent because the government back in Spain was getting too liberal. This was faithfully depicted, as was the period of bloody chaos from 1821 to 1848, the period of bloody chaos from 1858 to 1867, and the period of bloody chaos from 1911 to 1920. Artist Morey was forced to use every conceivable variation of the determined peasant with upraised face holding a gun in the air with one hand. Also portrayed was Benito Juarez, the Abraham Lincoln of Mexico, who freed the Indian peons but accidentally destroyed their livelihood by letting communal land fall into the hands of speculators. The comic opera emperor Maximilian, installed by Napoleon III because Mexico defaulted on French bank loans, Citibank, take note, and dictator Porfirio Diaz, who sold the country's natural resources to foreign companies for peanuts and gave press swine William Randolph Hearst a 2.5 million-acre ranch in Chihuahua as a thank you for good newspaper PR. In the middle of all this was a cluster of pale, slightly vampiric-looking characters in blue uniforms carrying a frightening and complicated flag full of stripes and things. They were taking California, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, and Texas away, Route 66 included. I drove to Ugalde's office in an industrial park on the edge of town. Why is Mexico so poor? Ugalde hemmed and hawed a while about the Mexican economic system and then blamed it on the Indians.
We never, said Ugalde, had the saying, the best Indian is a dead Indian. I will put it this way. We have three types of people. People in the south of Mexico, they want. People in the middle, they think. People in the north, they work.
What he meant was the south has the most Indians. And in the middle, Mexico City, the intelligentsia make their Indian heritage a point of pride. But in the north of Mexico, people are mostly European. We weren't going to get anywhere with this line of reasoning. I asked about Mexico's one-party system of government. What I have in my notes is, your gov. Fucked or what? Though I'm sure I phrased that differently.
If we had a perfect democracy, everyone votes without any education. You could hardly expect anyone to win, Ugalde said, going all glasnost and Gorbachev-y on me. There will be 5-6 parties. 70 million Mexicans want to be president, but only one can be. The PRI system has been the right people at the right time, avoiding dictatorship and political strife.
Then Ugaldi pulled out a heap of charts and graphs that he said showed Mexico's rapid pace of development.
"And the Japanese are coming soon," he said.
I told him I'd just spent a week with the United States Border Patrol, and I hadn't seen many signs of what you'd call rapid pace of development.
"People can go live in the U.S.," he said, as though it were a matter of whether to winter in Aspen or Palm Springs. "But it's hard. We are not so disciplined. We have to learn the laws and rules of living in a new place. There is a rigidity to the North. In Mexico, we have an expression."
He gave me that wised-up shrug.
"Everything is negotiable."
Ugalde sighed as though I'd made much more alarming allegations about the Mexican state of things than I had.
"Mexico," he said, "is rich in raw materials but poor in resources of technology and of ways to use technology."
In other words, somebody stole the half with all the paved roads. I left Ugalde's office and drove around the industrial park. It had been laid out in sectors like a spoked wheel. There were absolutely no buildings in the entire park except Ugalde's little office suite. Grass was growing in the pavement cracks, and in the middle of the park, at the hub, there was an enormous welded steel sculpture of Don Quixote tilting at a windmill. So what's going to happen at our southern border? Is an enormous, terrifying Beaner tidal wave going to roll across our fair nation? Well, we don't have to worry about that. It already has. We've suffered a huge invasion of cheerful, hard-working poor people who grabbed all the shit jobs nobody else wanted and caused a fearsome outbreak of Tex-Mex yuppie restaurants. We don't have a problem. It's the Mexicans who have the problem. And there are 4 billion other people in the world, most of them with even worse problems than the Mexicans have. Where are they going to go? The Holy Land, God's Monkey House. January 1988. You haven't really seen the old city of Jerusalem until you've seen it at dawn on a Muslim Sabbath while you're disguised as an Arab and accompanied by a guy who's probably with the PLO, plus two hulking press photographers in unlikely Bedouin headdresses, and all four of you are following the footsteps of Christ down the Via Dolorosa at a jog trot, running in and out of doorways, dodging Israeli army patrols. Old Jerusalem is a medieval city, not an adorably restored medieval city like Heidelberg, but a real one where you can smell the medieval sanitation and smack your head on the dirty, low medieval ceilings. The fortress-fronted, time-soiled limestone houses are built all over each other. The boulevards are steep, twisting, littered, and as wide as a donkey. Some streets are roofed in stone, most have steps cut in the pavement, and they seem more like staircases in a crypt than city avenues. Lamps are few, signposts date from the Ottoman Empire. Each shadow holds some sinister passage or dwarfish portcullis. The place is the original for every game of Dungeons and Dragons. At dawn in Jerusalem, you could be in any century of human civilization. The guy who was probably with the PLO, whom I'll call Ahmed, was smuggling me and my photographer friends Tony Swa and John Reardon into the forbidden precincts of the Haram Esh-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, enclosing the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Except for Mecca and Medina, these are Mohammedanism's most sacred shrines. Infidels are banned from the Haram's 35 acres on Friday, the Muslim Sabbath, and this Friday the sanctuary was also being sealed by Israeli soldiers and Jerusalem police. There had been an ugly incident the week before. After midday prayers, some kids displayed the illegal Palestinian flag, burned the flag of Israel, and of course the U.S. flag too, and threw stones. The Israelis responded with clubs and tear gas and, at one point, actually tossed a gas grenade inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The result was some coughing and sneezing, and lots of international indignation. Today, the Israelis would be checking identity cards at the sanctuary's 8 gates and letting in only respectable believers. Tony, John, and I had tried to slip into the Haram before the soldiers arrived. There was only one sleepy Muslim guard on duty at 6 a.m. at the Gate of the Tribes. We'd wrapped black and white checked kafiyas, traditional Arab kerchiefs, over our heads. But since I was wearing a Burberry trench coat and they were carrying 30 pounds of camera equipment, this wasn't much of a ruse. The elderly guard was having none of us. While we were arguing with him, Ahmed stepped out of a crowd of morning prayer-goers and took our part. This happens all the time in the Middle East. No matter who you're arguing with or what you're arguing about, some stranger will always come to your defense. They're generous with their contention. You never have to argue alone in the Arab world. When he couldn't prevail on the guard, Ahmed took us home to a warren of ancient stone rooms, though the furniture was Danish modern, and served us sticky tea and rolls and bread and coffee thick as syrup. Several of Ahmed's knuckles were enormously knobbed, and one of his fingers was bent at a sickening angle. There were scars around his wrists. He had been imprisoned by the Israelis for 4 years during the 70s, he said, for Palestinian activities, and again during the early 80s for helping a friend repair a gun. He said he had been tied in a chair once for 5 days with a black hood over his head.
It was beautiful when they would take me away to beat me.
He gave us that big grin everyone wears in these parts when they talk about something grisly,
because then I could breathe and see.
Ahmed claimed there would be a demonstration at Al-Aqsa and that the journalists, the Sahafi, must be inside the mosque to see how Jews treat Muslims in this holy place. He led us through the Arab quarter to the Via Dolorosa, which runs parallel to the Haram's north wall. Then he opened an iron door near the Ecce Homo Arch, the place where Pontius Pilate, saying, "Behold the man," presented a flogged Jesus to the Jerusalem mob. We went through somebody's house, across roofs and down concealed spiral stairs with stone treads worn hollow by 1,000 years of escapes and forays. It was a scene from an Indiana Jones movie, except the stairs opened into someone's modern bathroom. We went out through the kitchen, down one more flight of steps cut into the Haram's wall, and there, framed in a Byzantine Empire back door, was the Dome of the Rock, a big gold cupola rising from an octagon of royal blue tiles and set upon a vast stone platform, like a bonbon, on a deck of playing cards. Burnouses were produced to conceal Tony and John's photo gear. I ditched my trench coat, and Ahmed showed us how to fasten the kafiyas properly with the ukals, the tasseled headbands. Then we went, stiff with adrenaline, down the length of the Haram Esh-Sharif compound, past guards and policemen and fellow Muslims.
"Walk comfortable,"
whispered Ahmed with some irritation. Tony's cameras were clanging under his lumpy robe. Israeli soldiers lined the sanctuary walls, and helicopters swayed back and forth overhead. The dim interior of the Al-Aqsa Mosque was the size of a large suburban house lot. There were no furnishings at all, except luminous antique carpets spread 2 and 3 deep across the entire floor. Scores of columns, thick as automobiles, supported a roof so high it was nearly invisible. A few of the slippered worshippers knelt alone on prayer rugs. Others gathered in small groups along the walls. For the next 4 hours, Tony, John, and I hid in these majestic shadows, wondering what the hell we were doing. It was unlikely that the Israelis would let anything important erupt again in the Haram or overreact if it did. They'd taken too much flack about the mosque gassing. To put it in Protestant American terms, throwing a tear gas grenade into the Al-Aqsa Mosque on a Sabbath was like attacking the Pebble Beach golf course with Agent Orange on a Sunday in June. So we weren't going to see much action, and we weren't really doing our jobs either. Outside the sanctuary, all through the Israeli-occupied territories of Palestine's West Bank and Gaza Strip, there were riots, retaliations, strikes, curfews, stonings, shootings, beatings, shoutings, whinings, and wild excuse-makings, the complete falderal of a Mideastern political crisis. Eager, ambitious reporters would have been out there interviewing the pants off everybody and filing serious, indignant, yet balanced and thoughtful pieces. Instead, here we were, dressed like ninnies and sneaking around in mosques. However, dressing like ninnies and sneaking around in mosques is an important tradition among old Arab hands, dating back at least to 1853, when the explorer Sir Richard Burton dressed like a ninny for 9 whole months and managed to sneak all the way into the Holy Kaaba at Mecca. Like Sir Richard, T.E. Lawrence, and others before us, we were trying to penetrate the soul of the Arab, trying to become one with him and fathom the mystery of the East. It's just something you have to go through if you're going to be an old Arab hand, like eating a live guppy to get into Sigma Nu. Shortly before noon, as the mosque was beginning to fill, Ahmed suggested that I go outside and mingle. I thought this was a little too PJ of Arabia, especially since I look about as much like an average American jerk as it's possible to look and speak exactly two words of Arabic. But Ahmed thought I'd pass, thanks perhaps to a high school fistfight, which left me with a Levantine nose.
"If they start throwing stones," he said, "feel free to join in."
Pulling the keffiyeh down over my forehead to hood my blue eyes, I walked outside into a milling crowd of 2,000 Mohammedans. The crowd was all men and boys. Women pray separately in the dome of the rock. A few of the men were in church-going clothes, but most wore jeans and sweaters like my own. My deck shoes, not a popular fashion item with desert peoples, were the only anomaly. I didn't know quite what to do with myself, so I milled too. Fortunately, the Arabs are also fond of lounging. And I lounged for a while, leaning against pillars, sitting on the edge of fountains, that sort of thing. Nobody bothered me. Only a couple of small boys looked twice at my yokel face. The men were chatting or walking alone, lost in contemplation. Some strolled in pairs, holding hands. Then the muezzin called the faithful, and suddenly I was the only person not facing Mecca. Not many O'Rourkes have ever bowed to Mecca, but I did, and followed all the gestures and prostrations as best I could, half a beat behind the others, like singing along when you don't know the words. There was a peculiar casualness to the worship. People ambled in and out of the mosque all through the service. It was God as an informal thing, but a serious informal thing, the way lunch is when you're hungry. A large part of the crowd stayed outside, listening to loudspeakers mounted on Al-Aqsa's portico, listening as though they were hearing something they were actually interested in, not a sermon or a scripture reading. I grew up in the prim and glacial ceremonies of the Methodist Church, half grammar lesson, half drill inspection. It had never occurred to me that anyone might want to just come and hang out at a religious service. This was no stick-on decal god here, but a woven-in-the-cloth, blown-in-the-glass deity. In the Holy Land, God comes with the territory. And though I don't suppose the Muslims would like to hear it, Israel, too, has God as standard equipment. After all, here it is, the State of Israel, with no other rationale for existence except a promise from God. I wonder what a Methodist homeland would be like. Mandatory stay-pressed shirts, federal regulations about keeping feet off furniture, and automatic death penalty for anybody with crabgrass in his lawn. There was, in fact, a demonstration after prayers, though not a very exciting one. Men came out of Al-Aqsa and yelled. Women came out of the Dome of the Rock and shrieked. An imam, a portly visiting president of the mosque in some West Bank town, was hoisted upon shoulders and carried around the dome. Dozens of pocket-sized Qurans were waved in the air. I demonstrated a bit myself by milling around at a slightly faster pace than I'd milled before. True to Arab form, the demonstration immediately broke into two quarreling factions. The group hoisting the imam wanted to keep a strictly religious tone of outrage to the proceedings. The other group wanted to wave a small, homemade Palestinian flag and scream at the Israelis. The soldiers along the walls looked tense, and one platoon moved into the enclosure and stood along the edge of the dome's platform with weapons in array. But they didn't interfere. A few young Muslims made feints at collecting stones to throw, but didn't follow through. With nothing to oppose it, the demonstration died down in half an hour. By the time Tony, John, and I got smuggled out of the sanctuary, it was after 3 o'clock. Old Jerusalem was a very different place in the afternoon. Israeli soldiers pried at locks with crowbars, trying to force Muslim shopkeepers to end the general strike that started in December, while young Palestinian activists darted through the marketplaces warning merchants not to open. Arab boys of 10 and 12 were picking up rocks and chunks of cement and yelling encouragement to each other from the roofs. Armored personnel carriers, filled with irritable-looking draftees, squeezed along the few large streets. Islamic fundamentalists barked over PA systems from storefront mosques. Greek monks, Armenian priests, Catholic nuns, and Coptic whatsits lumbered around in full fig like parade floats. Ultra-Orthodox Jews plodded by, wearing ridiculous beaver hats and making sour faces. Jesus-addled German tourists strode over-energetically from one holy hotspot to the next. At dawn in Jerusalem, you could be in any century, but at mid-afternoon, you know exactly what century you're in, the 12th, when everybody was bashing everybody over the head about God. The rock over which the dome of the rock is built is supposed to be the altar where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac, until Yahweh explained he was just kidding. David parked the Ark of the Covenant here, and Muhammad is believed to have leapt into heaven with this rock as his trampoline. The hill the rock sits on, indistinguishable from the thousand other dumpy hills of Judea, is called the Temple Mount by the Jews, Haram es-Sharif by the Muslims, and Mount Moriah by the Christians. Solomon's Temple was here, and the great temple complex of Herod, destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. Thus, the western wall of the Haram is the Wailing Wall of the Jews, who bemoan their fate on one side of it, while the Muslims bemoan theirs on the other. The early Christians considered the place cursed because Jesus predicted the deconstruction of the temple. A safe enough prediction. The whole of Jerusalem has been destroyed more than 30 times. Score that round of theological debate to the early Christians. In fact, I think it can be fairly said that everything in the Holy Land is cursed. The Gaza Strip certainly is. I drove down there to take a look at the place where Israel's current batch of troubles began. The Strip is desolate and, at the same time, one of the most thickly populated places on earth. Desolately overpopulated, cursed Holy Land, blood-soaked home of the Prince of Peace, this region never seems to run out of oxymorons. Gaza City has the same crowded poverty as Arab Jerusalem, but it's all new and made of cement. The land around it, the mere 140 square miles that make up this gigantic international sore spot, should be a place of gilt sand beaches and graceful dunes dotted with palms and oasis wells. Instead, it's Hell's Riviera, with 8 refugee camps housing 250,000 people. The Palestinians in these camps were displaced by the 1948 war, the one Paul Newman and Eva Marie Saint won in Exodus. Since then, they've been temporarily sheltered by the jack-off UN, ruled first by useless Egyptian bureaucracy, then by cold-hearted Israeli military fiat, ignored by the Western Bloc, exploited by the Eastern Bloc, and just left there, like live bait in a geopolitical leg trap by their fellow Arabs. In between the refugee camps are some ratty Arab farms. Palestinians, unlike Israeli citizens, do not get subsidized irrigation water. Also, in between the camps are Jewish settlements. I have no idea why. The Jews have no biblical claim to Gaza, except for some exploits of Samson's. Then went Samson to Gaza, and saw there a harlot, and went in unto her. Judges, chapter 16, verse 1. The settlements are cheerless places, surrounded by armed guards and barbed wire, and featuring the usual dreadful Israeli architecture, a style that crosses the worker housing of Gdansk with the branch banks of Hollywood, Florida. All the refugee camps had been put under curfew, which meant no one could stir outside the shack houses at any time for any reason. The curfew was lifted for only an hour or so a day, the time never announced beforehand. Even then, only the women could go outside and get food. I made my way into the largest of the camps, Jabalia, which houses 52,000 people in what looks like, from a distance, a valley full of packing crates with electrical lines. Entering the camp was a less romantic business than getting into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and more dangerous, too. In the occupied territories, unlike Jerusalem, the Israelis were shooting people. I crawled into Jabalia through a scraggly vineyard and spent an unhappy 5 minutes with my gut pressed to the sand, trying to look like a grape plant while an armored personnel carrier rolled along a nearby road. I visited an architect there named Ali, who did not miss the irony of being an architect in a 2-room cinder block house with a corrugated asbestos roof. I could see daylight all around the eaves in the 8-by-10-foot living room. There was no heat, and a cold wind was blowing off the Mediterranean. Ali said the camp had been under curfew for 7 days. The Israeli-controlled electricity had been cut off twice, and at one point, the water mains were shut for 3 days. People had to drink from rain barrels. The food in the camp stores had all run out, and the break in the curfew was not long enough for the women to walk into town and back. Money, too, had about run out because of the Palestinian general strike and the fact that no one could get to work anyway. However, the United Nations was usually allowed to distribute food to children and nursing mothers once a day, and an informal smuggling network had grown up around the camp perimeters. Nobody was going hungry yet. Ali counted himself lucky. There were only 5 in his family.
Some people in the camp had households of 10 or 15. I asked Ali's wife what she was feeding her kids.
"Bread and tea for breakfast," she said, "and tomatoes and vegetables that are smuggled."
There was no meat or milk. She had no more said that than Ali invited me to stay for dinner. You can't.